Republicans to wake up is the Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to
do it live.
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
I'd like to thank the people who support this program by subscribing, like James Smith, Stephen King, Joey Hundert, and Michael Gill. If you haven't subscribed already, join the gang. Log on to peterbcollins.com. And if you take out an annual subscription, you automatically get a copy of our bonus book. Here comes a powerful conversation with a whistleblower who used to work on Capitol Hill, and she has sued the government to get her computer and her reputation back. My guest today is Diane S. Rourke, who is a former senior staffer at the House Intelligence Committee and joins us from what I presume to be her retirement in Oregon. Diane, welcome to our program. And are you retired and are you enjoying it?
I'm retired and I'm working just as hard as I ever did.
Well, there's a lot to talk about, and I appreciate your willingness to chat with me. Let's start with the most recent events. You have sued the government to recover your computer. Tell us what the issues are there and why they absconded with your computer.
Well, it's my computer and papers, but actually my suit is largely a constitutional lawsuit, which also seeks to prohibit these practices in the future and establish some case law allowing people to dispute them.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
To them. So I'm looking at violations of my First Amendment, Fourth Amendment, Fifth and Sixth Amendment rights.
Mm-hmm. And this arises from an investigation that was related to the ultimate prosecution of Thomas Drake, who worked at the National Security Administration. Is that essentially true?
That's true.
Okay. And so it's about 5 years ago that FBI agents knocked on your door and conducted a search and then walked away with your documents and your computer.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And that was
July
26th. July of 2007.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And was there a national security letter presented? Was there a court-ordered warrant? What was the basis of this search and seizure?
A warrant was provided to me, but they refused to provide the affidavit and never have. The warrant stated that they were looking primarily for information about the warrantless wiretaps leak, and also about a series of articles in the Baltimore Sun, in particular one on the so-called thin thread program.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And that, again, is part and parcel of the Drake investigation. And ultimately, Thomas Drake pled guilty to a minor charge of, I believe, misusing a government computer as the federal case against him collapsed. Has there ever been an effort to try you? Have you ever been formally accused of any breach of your security clearance from back when you worked at the House of Representatives or any other alleged violation?
No. They came to me in December of 2009. Basically, we heard very little from them for many years. I did meet with them in February of 2007. They were accusatory, but at the end, it was a friendly meeting, and I thought everything was okay, and then they suddenly raided me in July, about 5 months later, and then I never heard from them again for a long time until December of 2009, and they approached my attorney and ask that I plead guilty to a felony of having lied during my February 2007 discussion with them.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out it was their lie, not mine. I had said in response to a question about the warrantless wiretaps and who might have leaked it, I said I had absolutely no idea whatsoever who had leaked it.
And that in specific is the work of Eric Lichtblau and Risen at
James Risen
at the New York Times. Mm-hmm. And their investigation was completed sometime in the fall of 2004, but not published until early December of 2005.
Yes, the newspaper apparently refused to publish it until it was apparent that Risen was going to go ahead and publish his book with
right.
a chapter on that issue in January mm-hmm. of 2006.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And so the bottom line here, Diane, is that you have been smeared. And that while you've never been charged with any crime, even the news accounts of your recent lawsuit report that you have been accused and that you are a suspect in the disclosures of Risen and Lichtblau and apparently a suspect in the communication between Tom Drake and the reporter at the Baltimore Sun.
Yes, on the last, they falsely alleged that I had kind of goaded him to contact the reporter, and in fact, it was the opposite. I told him I was very fearful that he had a lot to lose, including his job, even if he gave unclassified information, which I knew he would not give classified, but I was afraid that he would lose his job because the regulations at NSA required that you go through a public relations person.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew they were very vindictive. So, in fact, it was the opposite. I cautioned him against it.
And tell me about your last comment there. You knew they were very vindictive. You're now the subject of the kind of retaliation from a government agency that you used to play an oversight role with.
That's correct. I had their account for 5 years.
Mm-hmm. And so you were aware of the kind of retaliation that they visited on whistleblowers like Russ Tice, for example?
Well, I was aware of some problems internally. There were a couple of people who were dealt with very harshly because some things got out that were embarrassing to the administration of NSA. And it wasn't anything they did wrong, but one person lost their job. One person was probably his career was badly affected.
Mm-hmm. So there's only one case during that five-year period where you saw retaliation that you thought was either misguided or an overreaction?
Well, there was at least one other one. Somebody was accused, who made kind of a flip comment, was accused of going against established policy. I don't even remember. It was in front of me. I don't even remember the comment, frankly.
Hmm.
But he was switched to a different job, and his career was affected also.
Uh-huh.
And actually, some of the other fellow litigants who were accused of doing some things and not given a chance to defend themselves, and their careers basically went downhill too, and they eventually decided to retire.
Now, Diane, I've interviewed a number of whistleblowers across various federal agencies. And one of the common threads is that, in general, these are individuals who have security clearances. And those clearances are essential for them to hold and keep and function in their jobs. And one of the things that we've seen is that often a first step is to trim or completely withdraw a security clearance, which makes a spook not very scary.
That's correct. Both Tom had a security clearance and was still working under the auspices of NSA, and another of the litigants, Ed Loomis, had a very good contract job. They both lost very high-paying jobs and have not received their clearance back. In Ed's case, he demanded to look at his personnel folder and finally got it, and there was nothing adverse in the folder. And for the rest of us, We were still doing some work on the outside, some consulting work, and Bill Binney and Kirk Wiebe were also trying to develop some technology that they had and to sell it to the intelligence community. Mm-hmm. And so they were unable to do that afterward.
Now, Diane, let's talk about you a little bit, because I spent some time reading up on you, and I recall a reference to you in Jane Mayer's article about Thomas Drake in The New Yorker. That's about 18 months ago, as I recall. But there are two things that stand out from what I've learned about Diane Rourke. Number one, that you were feared by the agencies that you oversaw in your role as a top staff person on the House Intelligence Committee. And the other is that you seem to have a clear reading of the Fourth Amendment. And so those draw me in a positive way to you just from the get-go. Because, number one, I feel that Congress has largely sloughed off its oversight responsibilities, in particular since 9/11. And I'm very troubled by that. And secondly, I'm pretty much of a purist on the Fourth Amendment. It's a very explicit, unambiguous clause in the Bill of Rights. And I believe that it is violated on a routine and widespread basis daily.
Yes, I would agree with you on both those points. It's true that on the last two accounts I had, including the NSA account, I felt that they were spending an awful lot more money than they should have. In NSA's case, it was, I was very concerned they had no concrete vision, that they didn't have the technical capability to carry it out, that they were floundering, and they were wasting billions of dollars. When I kind of got the brush off with them, I got very tough. So, yes, they didn't like me. And with regard to the Fourth Amendment, yes, I would completely agree with you. I believe Congress is absolutely worthless on this, with the exception of a few people in the Senate who lately, like Ron Wyden and Mark Udall, mm-hmm. and some others who have tried to do a few things. But for a decade now, Congress has let them do anything they wanted, pretty much. And it started when I was still there before I retired. I tried to get Porter Goss and Nancy Pelosi to do something about this when I found out what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
And I think overall the causes are, it's political accommodation to the administration, both administrations now. They're afraid that if there is another attack, that if they exert any leadership and really give oversight both of the legal issues and of the intelligence agency's expenditure of funds, that they will be blamed if there is another attack. And I was told that directly after 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
And so they basically backed off and let them do anything they wanted. And I think another issue is that there is no public, very little public anger over this. There's no public pressure.
Yeah.
And so they defer to the administration and don't do their jobs.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you, since you specifically mentioned Nancy Pelosi, I've known her for more than 20 years, since she first entered the Congress. And just in the interest of full disclosure, I worked for her as a campaign consultant once in 1996. So we have a good rapport. And certainly since she's entered the leadership, I haven't had as much access to her. And I've had a few conversations, and a few of them have been terribly substantive. But knowing how much, for example, she crusaded against most favored nation status for China all through the 1990s based on her commitment to human rights. And she did so over the objections of her own party's leaders, including President Clinton on many occasions. So she had, at least in her history, the ability to stand up for important principles. But following 9/11, I've been sorely disappointed, particularly because I know she was briefed on the torture regimes. I know she was briefed on the wiretapping efforts. The timing may be inexplicit, and so I will, you know, tend to understand how some of these things develop. But my point is that I have seen Congresswoman Pelosi really change and become part of the establishment in ways that we're describing now, particularly related to the Fourth Amendment, that I find deeply troubling. So could you tell me your perception of Ms. Pelosi during this time frame and the level of her complicity with the expansion of presidential authority unchecked by congressional oversight?
Yes, I would agree with you. Unfortunately, both your senators, both Ms. Feinstein and Ms. Pelosi, have been big administration supporters in this area. Ms. Pelosi was at the time the ranking Democrat on the House Intelligence Committee, where I was the staffer.
Mm-hmm.
When I found out about this, I deliberately wrote memos to both Republican and Democratic staff directors and via them to their members, because I wanted it to be a bipartisan thing, not a partisan thing. And I wrote them a whole series of memos as I came to know more about the programs, telling them exactly what was in it and why it was wrong and why it was, this is very important, completely unnecessary, that the civil liberties could have been protected.
Mm-hmm.
But the protections that had been built into the program were deliberately taken off and for no good reason.
And here we're talking about Trailblazer, right?
No, we're not. Trailblazer is the failed program.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of confusion on this, but Trailblazer was the failed modernization program that I and others on the Hill tried to get canceled.
Okay, and Thin Thread was the one that did initially protect civil liberties and came in at a much lower cost, right?
That was a competitor to Trailblazer, yes. And yes, it did develop some very good technology, and it also developed very, very effective protections, far more effective than those that had been previously used at NSA. But Thin Thread is also separate somewhat from the program that eventually was used.
Mm-hmm.
But basically, they used some technology that did have protections built in, and they took them off for unknown reasons. And I am at a loss to tell you why, frankly. It might have been because of a desire to expand presidential authority in wartime. And the white paper that was released after the wireless wiretaps leaked, it was released by the Department of Justice, it did say specifically that they, during wartime, they did not have to gather intelligence in the least in the manner that was least intrusive to civil liberties.
Hmm.
That was buried about toward the end of the paper.
And what was that based on? The authorization for use of military force that was rammed
used
through?
That to say it was basically a war, that basically indicated it was a war.
But we didn't suspend the Constitution. That I mean, what you're describing here was a backdoor suspension of certain parts of our Constitution.
Yes, but it was quite clear that that's what happened. And the Justice Department did have a historical review of how this has happened in the past during World War II and so on, when Roosevelt went ahead with Lend-Lease, and before Lend-Lease, with some things that Congress mm-hmm. had prohibited from doing. There were illegal things that were done, and Japanese internment was another one.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, they basically argued that historically, Abraham Lincoln was another president during the Civil War. And so they argued that historically presidents have had a lot freer hand during wartime. And I know for a fact, because General Hayden told me, that the legality of this program was based on wartime power.
Mm-hmm. Can you describe that conversation with General Hayden? It was referenced by Jane Mayer in the New Yorker article I mentioned earlier. And he seemed trying to calm you down and kind of talk you down from a strong embrace of the Fourth Amendment. And just he sounded condescending and paternalistic. That was the that was the sense I picked up. Would you agree or disagree with that?
I don't know that I would. I wouldn't say condescending and paternalistic, but he definitely was trying to persuade me to back off. At that time, I had retired in April. This was in July, my conversation with him. But I was still trying to get people to put some controls on his program or else eliminate it.
Mm-hmm.
And in part, I was communicating with Porter Goss. And, well, what happened was that Hayden's office called me and said that Mr. Goss had asked that I see him and they wanted to set up an appointment. So I called Mr. Goss and I asked what he had in mind. And he said that was incorrect. He did not ask for an appointment, but he thought it would be good for me to talk to General Hayden because we talked the same language. In other words, that a lot of these technical issues were beyond the members.
Mm-hmm.
And so I agreed to the appointment. I went to see him. And it looked to me like he was trying to get me to back off from lobbying the members, and Mr. Goss in particular. I think after I talked to him once, Mr. Goss did call a meeting and ask about some issues that I had raised.
Mm-hmm. And this is when Goss was still a congressman, a member of the Intelligence Committee, and before he was made the head of the CIA.
Right. He was the chairman of the Intelligence Committee at the time.
Right.
And anyway, I think he wanted me to simply back off and get Mr. Goss not to pursue this any further. And I was also seeing some other people.
Mm-hmm.
I tried both the judicial, the judicial, executive, and legislative, all three branches. I tried to do what I could
mm-hmm.
and was unsuccessful ultimately. But it was clear to me that he wanted me to back off. He said he wanted to run the program as long as he could. He agreed that eventually it would leak. Everybody agreed that. But he wanted to run it as long as he could.
Mm-hmm. Now, coming back to these memos that you wrote to the leaders of both parties who sit on the Intelligence Committee, specifically, what was the reaction of Nancy Pelosi? Did she say, oh, have a chocolate, nice memo, let's talk about the weather?
Well, I never spoke to Ms. Pelosi in person about it. What I did was write the memos to them through their staff directors, so
mm-hmm.
I talked a lot to her staff director. And it is a big disappointment to me that afterward Mrs. Pelosi has denied a lot of these things. First of all, when the leak occurred in the New York Times in December of 2005, Mrs. Pelosi subsequently claimed that she did not know. She had not been told everything about the program. Well, I don't know what the administration told her, but I told her a lot. And then, subsequently, when the mayor article came out years later, they denied that the memo that the staff director had given her the memos, but I know for a fact that he had.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. I'll just tell you as an aside that I saw Nancy Pelosi at a memorial service about 9 months ago, and we were having a nice little chit-chat conversation, and I could tell it was almost over. And I said, Nancy, I know you have a lot of things on your list. I said, but I'd like my Fourth Amendment back. And I also have done this with Mike Thompson, a Democrat from here in California who's on the Intelligence Committee. And the reaction is so unusual. They don't expect anybody to bring this up.
Yeah.
And they, Pelosi just looked at me and smiled and shook my hand and said, it's really good to see you, Peter. And, I don't expect her to, in a moment like that, to engage in a detailed conversation. But just the reactions of these intelligence-briefed individuals, she's no longer on the committee. But she's certainly, very well aware of all of the information that's circulating. And so it really just is interesting to me to see their reaction when somebody indicates that they have some idea of what's going on and they don't like it.
Yes, Ron Paul is the only one that has made an issue of this. It's very disappointing. Mitt Romney is actually, he thinks there should be more freedom to do what they want. of course, you know, Mr. Obama has prosecuted many, many people now for whistleblowing and has been, I think he's very, wants to control the information a lot. He's very much against leaks in general. And the intelligence bureaucracy has gotten to him on this, and I don't think he has any objective information. But I think they wanted to make an example of people.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty clear to me.
Well, I think it's very important to hear it from your voice, that this administration that has this phony claim of being the most transparent, the administration that accepted an award for its transparency in secret,
yeah.
and I just think that most people, particularly, you know, hardcore Democrats and Obama supporters, are either oblivious or remain, you know, kind of intentionally ignorant about the level of this expansion of a crackdown on whistleblowers. And some of this is egged on by my senior senator from here in California, Dianne Feinstein, who chairs the Senate Intelligence Committee. And, Diana, I find it deeply offensive that since the most recent calculated leaks, probably from the White House, about the killer capture program, about Stuxnet, that Feinstein wants to crack down on leakers and doesn't appear to be concerned about the important information that has been revealed. And Feinstein seems content that her staffers get to watch videotapes of some of the drone strikes on alleged terrorists, and that that is sufficient oversight of this massive expansion of a new kind of warfare into areas where we have no authority to conduct these kinds of raids. And so as I see this happening under a president who I voted for, I find it deeply disturbing. And the only thing that's more disturbing is how much people accept it without any resistance or even vocalization.
Yes, I am particularly concerned about the cybersecurity bill and how that is going to make it even worse. And like you said, the Stuxnet example that you raised is, I am also very concerned about the administration's and NSA strategy from here forward. It looks, General Hayden has said that cyber warfare is the game of the future, and he's made it clear that we intend to be, you know, on the offense sometimes in that. And but people who live in glass houses shouldn't be throwing stones, maybe. I mean, maybe we should stop and think about this. And the other part of it is that this increased legal authority for private companies and for the government to exchange information that is private is very, very troublesome,
mm-hmm.
especially given NSA's record.
Now, I'd like to turn to what I learned from Mark Klein, who worked for AT&T until he retired. And it's important to note that Mr. Klein did not have a security clearance. It's one of the reasons that he was able to publish his book. And he disclosed that he watched as a room at the Folsom Street facility owned by AT&T here in San Francisco was declared secret. And then all kinds of gear started arriving, and he was able to observe what some of that gear was, and he actually put together an inventory list at one point. And so what he revealed to us is this massive interception of data traffic, both voice and data, email, text messages, all that stuff, that is routinely and entirely diverted into this fiber optic switch. And now James Bamford has helped us understand that with this huge new server farm in Utah, they have the ability to collect these, you know, mind-boggling amounts of information and then use voice identification and all kinds of other spiffy developments in software to analyze this. And this was all rolled over in the 2008 so-called FISA Reform Act. And another link to Pelosi, her former chief of staff, Michael Yockey, who in 2008 headed the Democratic Platform Committee, was very candid with me in an interview because I objected to the cave-in that was represented by the FISA reforms. They were passed in early August and then were at the convention in Denver in late August. And I said, I'm very concerned about that. You just immunized the phone companies. You prevented any lawsuits or discovery of the extent of the wiretapping that we suspect is going on. And he smiled and he looked at me and said, yeah, we just took that issue off the table. And I said, well, wait a minute. I'm not so concerned about the fall campaign and taking an issue off the table. I said, that's a fundamental constitutional right. And all he could say was, well, Peter, we've taken that issue off the table. And it's never coming back to the table, is it, Diane?
Not unless we make a big row about it. And everybody has to get a lot more concerned than they are now. There is a lot, in addition to Mark Klein's information, that has come out in the public and been officially acknowledged. And most people haven't put it together, but there is a lot of confirmation that this is extremely intrusive. A lot of agencies are involved in it, besides NSA, the FBI, the CIA, the DIA, it has been alleged, and that they're collecting a very wide span of information. Klein, the first one to come out actually was Russell Tice,
mm-hmm.
When warrantless wiretaps were revealed in 2005 and again later in 2009, he talked about what all was being done, and he said that financial information was being, in addition to credit card information, and that journalists were being tracked. And Alberto Gonzalez also announced at one time that the technology was being used against leakers, and so that implies that journalists were being attacked with it. And it was also the credit card part of it was also verified by Michael Leiter, who was a former counterterrorist center director for CIA, and he said that they had already had that ability to collect credit card information under other laws. And then Mark Udall said on the Senate floor that there was a bulk collection of private data, including, for instance, things like telephone data.
Mm-hmm. Well, and most recently,
Ron Wyden also said that he was very concerned about the business clause in the FISA. In the Patriot Act, which mm-hmm. also supports this.
And I'm glad you raised that. I was just going there. That Senator Wyden recently got this bizarre memo back from DNI, the Director of National Intelligence, instructing him what he could or couldn't say. Regarding his very serious concerns about what he vaguely describes as an interpretation of the Patriot Act that would be deeply alarming to every American if it became public. And so Wyden is working to try to bring a little sunshine, but it's rather remarkable to see a sitting United States senator told what he could or couldn't say.
Yes, he has to be very careful because given the way Congress has been acting, he could be kicked off the Senate Intelligence Committee. I suppose he could even be prosecuted. I don't know if they would go that far mm-hmm. if they feel he reveals too much. And the Senate leadership has refused to accept amendments, has refused to discuss these things on the floor. So, you know, there's with the top leadership in both houses behind the administration, it's very difficult to do anything, and also the top chairman of the committees.
Yeah. No, I've known Feinstein even longer than Pelosi, and she's consistent, I'll say that. None of what she's doing, you know, related to trying to plug leaks and crack down on leakers in order to preserve the secrecy of programs that I consider immoral, illegal, and unconstitutional, that is very consistent behavior on the part of Dianne Feinstein. But, Diane, I want to come back to what you mentioned there about the press, because in my conversation with Russell Tice, he pointed out that they set up this special program that was intended to prevent the wiretapping of journalists. And it appears that it was a fake, and that, in fact, that while it said it was designed to protect the rights of journalists, It was a cover for a program that was monitoring the communications of journalists. And Risen and Lichtblau both believe and have asserted that their communications were intercepted. I don't have a date time on those allegations, but they have been made.
Yes, I have seen that too. I've seen Mr. Risen's statement in that regard. There's quite a bit of evidence behind his statement too. It's really very distressing. I have to agree with you. And when Gonzalez said publicly that they were going to use the technology for that purpose, you have to assume that they did.
Mm-hmm. And have you followed at all the case called U.S. versus, or actually it was Al-Haramain versus the U.S.? That is one of the successful cases where Judge Vaughn Walker, retired from federal court here in San Francisco, did clearly rule that the plaintiffs were illegally wiretapped. He awarded money damages and attorney's fees to the victims of this. And it appears that this will be appealed. But as it stands, that is the clearest finding of illegal wiretapping that occurred following 9/11.
Yes, they actually had the evidence, but the government tried to suppress it. During discovery, this case was originally tried in Ashland, Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
And it was an Islamic charity that is alleged to have been funneling money to Islamic radicals. And they claimed they did not know or intend that it go to radicals. But anyway, what happened was that during the discovery phase, when they received government documents, they found within their documents that there was an actual list of all their intercepted conversations,
right.
An NSA list. And they did notify the government of this, and the government demanded it back and that they not retain any copies or anything, I assume, and then acted like it didn't exist,
mm-hmm.
basically quashed it. So that was, and I think, if I am correct, I believe, maybe you know, I believe there were attorney-client conversations in there also.
Yes, there were.
Mm-hmm. And anyway, so that was the only actual evidence that have surfaced. And one of the problems in the court, there have been a lot of court cases brought on this so far, but one problem is the government invocation of secrecy,
yes.
which the courts have been reluctant to challenge. And the second one is that the plaintiff does not have standing if he cannot prove
right.
that he was intercepted, and of course the government will never admit that they were intercepted, so it's hard for them to prove it.
It's the perfect catch-22.
Yes, it's exactly that, and that the courts stand for this is just beyond me.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting, ultimately in the Al-Haramain case, they were able to establish to a level of persuading Judge Walker using public information.
Yes.
Because apparently a second-level executive at the FBI gave a speech that the lawyers were able to find with a Google search where he admitted that they had wiretapped Al-Haramain.
Uh-huh.
And so that was what enabled the case to go forward and reach at least that conclusion. And I've talked to the attorney for that group, John Eisenberg, on many occasions, and it's just bizarre, Diane, the way the state secrets privilege was asserted, and Eisenberg was ordered to respond to briefs that he wasn't allowed to read. He never really saw the details of the government complaint, and basically, you know, was shooting in the dark. And at one point, he went into the federal building here in San Francisco and wrote, potential responses to arguments that he expected the government to make, but had no knowledge if they actually had or not. And I have never seen anything like this. I have to take that back. We never saw anything like this before the so-called War on Terror was launched.
Yes. And, you know, another point that nobody really pays attention to is that the United States is treating this much differently than other countries using apparently similar technology. Two of our closest Reagan allies, the UK and Australia, have presented to their publics the desire to institute programs that are also very intrusive. And you should realize also with our SIG and allies, we often share technology.
And let me just translate SIG, INT, signal intelligence. It's the interception of communications.
Yes. I'm sorry. I lapsed into intelligences.
That's okay. I can do a little bit of real-time translation.
Anyway, yes. So they have taken it to their publics. The UK, I believe it was turned down the first time around. There was a big row. They have recently raised the possibility again, and now Australia is asking its public to approve it too.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if it is so darn secret, why can they do it when we can't? And why is it so secret for us that it can be kept out of the courts, much less, you know, put to the public? I just think it's the other thing in this regard is that it became eminently clear, in particular with the capture of bin Laden, although it was obvious before that, all the terrorists know that what we're doing. And there's been a lot of publicity on this, and they know what we're doing. So they are taking the precautions. So it's not like this is going to have a huge effect on collection. If the government seriously discusses with the public what they're doing and asks them to approve it.
Well, you just delivered the line that explains why they're retaliating against you, Diane. You're thinking rationally.
Well, the government has been irrational in this. I really do believe. I do not understand what is behind it. There doesn't seem to be a legitimate reason. And the other reason, too, is that a lot of this technology got changed for the worse. There was some very good technology that went into it, but they changed it technically, and they also changed the operational rules for it.
Mm-hmm.
And it became far less effective. And there is a very important report that most people don't pay attention to. It was the Joint Inspector General report of July 2009, which was released in an unclassified version. And it was five inspectors general from the intelligence community, and they basically affirmed that there were many activities that remained classified. And the administration still likes to pretend that all that there is the program that was released, that leaked in December of 2009, which was between domestic, which was domestic and communications with foreign entities
mm-hmm.
who were suspected of terrorism. But what this report did was it affirmed that that was only a part of the program. They basically named the program when it leaked. They named it the terrorist surveillance program, that part of the program. And then to give you an indication of the sleight of hand that is occurring, General Hayden became the point person to deal with this. And he said at the beginning of the press conference, I am only going to discuss the TSP, which is what leaked. And so every time he got a question about intrusiveness or anything else, he just said, no, it's not intrusive.
Mm-hmm.
But what it was it was only part of a broader program called the President's Surveillance Program, or PSP. And that included many things that still have not been officially revealed. And that was affirmed in this IG report. And it also said that while the scope of collection had changed over time, some or all of the activities persisted. So that indicates we know there have been changes. After the hospital confrontation, so-called hospital confrontation in May of 2000 or March of 2004.
That's when Ashcroft was on what was considered to be a deathbed at that point. He survived. But Gonzalez and Card came over from the White House. And who was the acting attorney general?
Oh, it starts with a C. I'm trying to remember his name.
Yeah.
He
had a moment of principle there. And Ashcroft, actually, it was one of the few things that inspired any respect for him from me because he refused to sign that extension of, and this again is the PSP, the Presidential Surveillance Program, which you're telling us is much broader than the TSP.
Yes. Apparently the real conflict was over the PSP part, And the Justice Department was finally putting down its foot and saying it was illegal. And it turns out there is also a recent, there was an article subsequently that gave some of the background on this, and it said that Bush apparently, even after the Ashcroft refused, Bush was going to override him.
Mm-hmm.
But the director of the FBI, Mueller, as well as Comey, that was his name.
James Comey, yes.
Yes, went to talk to Bush and told him that there was going to be an en masse resignation at the top levels of justice as well as by Mueller if
mm-hmm.
they went ahead.
Mm-hmm.
And so Bush backed off. There were some changes made in the program at that time, but we don't know what they were. There was another big confrontation between the FISA court and the intelligence agencies after the amendment was passed in 2008. Apparently, collection was shut down for at least 4 months because the FISA court found out they were doing things that they didn't think was allowed under the amendment.
Hmm. And what was the time frame of that, before or after the 08?
After the 08 amendment. So the uh-huh. 08 amendment gave them, you know, it basically legalized everything they had been doing, it
right.
was thought.
Uh-huh.
But it turns out the justices didn't realize fully what they were doing.
Hmm. Wow. Diane, I want to just ask you about one episode that would have occurred just about before you retired. And I've always been curious about this, and I don't know if you can actually shed any light on it. But in the initial days of the wiretapping program, there was one phone company that resisted. It was Quest in Denver. And Quest revealed in some of the coverage that they had been asked to provide access to local telephone switches. And that's why they resisted. The argument advanced was, well, we got to intercept any calls from terrorists into the United States. And Quest said, well, then why are you asking for access to domestic and actually, you know, point-to-point calls inside our coverage area? And all I know is that Quest lost that battle, and its CEO ended up convicted of insider trading charges that I've never been able to assess the validity of. So can you shed any light on the Quest episode and what actually occurred there?
You know, I don't know what the truth is behind that, but it stinks to me. You're right, he is in jail, and I don't know anything about the legal issues involved, but I do know that he alleged that after he refused to do that, that he lost extensive government contracts, which in turn put his company in financial peril.
Mm-hmm.
And that some of his actions apparently after that to try to save the company, as I gather, were the ones that were contested legally. So I think it's quite possible they also ganged up on him. And he's in jail now, and he protested to the end that this was part of his defense.
Yeah.
But it was, I don't believe it was allowed in court.
Mm-hmm. So, Diane, one of the things that I have found in talking to people who somehow earn the label of whistleblower is that none of them ever sought that distinction. And you're now described as a whistleblower. You spent, I believe, 18 years working on the House Intelligence Committee, or at least as a congressional staffer. And to see your efforts, which I have to believe were good faith, motivated by your belief in the rule of law and the contract that is the Constitution between our government and its people, to see yourself slimed, to see you have to sue the government you worked for to try to recapture some of your reputation and hopefully get your computer and other papers back, tell me how you feel to be in this position today.
I feel it's very unjust. That's why I am suing. But the larger reason I'm suing is to, as I said, to make sure this doesn't happen to other people, that they can't get by with these things. I just felt I was doing my job. I didn't feel I was a whistleblower. And I just felt I had to do my job. My job was oversight. It included making sure that their budget, you know, that their funds were being spent properly, and also that they were not exceeding the laws operationally. So it was my job to do this. Also, I had funded part of the technology that they used. I can't say I'd funded it by myself, but I had argued for it in Congress. It was ads that were added to their budget, and I felt morally, you know, I felt I had to do this because I was morally responsible for part of it, and I did not realize that I was a target for the longest time. It just escaped my, I just couldn't believe it. For one thing, if with regard to warrantless wiretaps, if they thought that I was leaking after I went to everybody I could think of to object to it, wouldn't that have been pretty stupid of me? Yes, it's very disconcerting. Another reason they went after me, in addition to my efforts in my job, was that after I retired, the five of us who were raided, which included Tom Drake, Bill Binney, Ed Loomis, Kirk Wiebe, the five of us both instigated and helped the Inspector General of the Department of Defense to investigate the modernization program at NSA that was wasting billions of dollars. And the report came back that was, as I am told, devastating against NSA. And even then, they didn't stop their program, but eventually they had to halt it years later after wasting billions more. So they were always angry about that, and I think that led them to retaliate against all of us.
And to what extent do you believe that this retaliation is driven by embarrassment as opposed to any realistic breach of security clearance or violation of the law?
100%. It is very clear. It came out in the Drake trial. There were pretrial hearings in the Drake trial, and both those hearings and the fact that Drake continued to refuse to plea bargain forced them to drop the case, because as it turned out, they had no evidence. They had no evidence that either of us had leaked warrantless wiretaps, and so they went after us for talking to the Baltimore Sun. And I had talked to Siobhan Gorman of the Baltimore Sun about two articles she wrote, one on the modernization program and one on Thin Thread. But we never, neither of us ever said anything classified.
Mm-hmm.
And as it turned out, the government admitted that none of the Sun articles were classified. They admitted that there was nothing ever published that was classified. And most people don't realize that. So they had nothing. They had no evidence whatsoever.
So let me ask you, as you observe the impending court-martial of Private Bradley Manning, and let me just stipulate that I'll await proof of any crimes that he may have committed, but it appears that he, in an act of civil disobedience, did disclose massive amounts of secret, not top secret, but secret information that had been classified. He had access to it. He allegedly gave it to WikiLeaks. Now, you're a person who worked on the inside, who had and honored a security clearance, and I respect that. On the other hand, we have Manning, who did not reveal any top-secret information, and the president has expressly asserted that in a taped conversation at a fundraiser here in San Francisco a year ago, April. How do you view the way his court-martial is being handled, and is this a political show trial? Or, in your view, is this a realistic enforcement of the standards that people who agree to security clearances must uphold?
I have to say I haven't followed the Manning trial closely, just periodically. I see something about it. I would have to say that you can't protect only top secret. You also have to protect secret information. And I am very concerned about the wholesale release of classified information. You can't take it upon yourself to simply release thousands of documents. And it is also true that our diplomats, to in order to operate effectively, do have to have be able to accept and give information confidentially. It is also, it appears, that some of those documents from Afghanistan and elsewhere revealed sources that could be retaliated against. So I cannot say that I support that. You know, I just cannot. There is a point to the classification system. But on the other hand, I have to also agree there things are way overclassified often. And in Tom Drake's case, in his trial, the government retroactively tried to classify five documents that were not classified in order to get him. And so there are a lot of abuses of the classification system. I'm not saying that everything that's classified should be classified by any means. In fact, in our case, that's very obvious that a lot of this was unclassified, not just the Drake items. And right now, the government is trying to say that there is classified on our computers in our conversations among ourselves. And even that there is unclassified that has not been revealed officially by the NSA, and so that allows them to seize everything we have.
Yeah. And when you look at the pretrial treatment of Bradley Manning, the solitary confinement, the enforced nudity, some of these other techniques that kind of come off of Rumsfeld's list of enhanced interrogation, do you feel comfortable with that?
No, I don't. And again, it's a part of anything goes. You know, it just seems this attitude of anything goes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, Diana, I want to thank you for talking with me today, and I've certainly learned a lot, and I appreciate what you are doing. And if there's ever anything I can do to amplify your voice, I share with you this concern that the American public is sleeping through a very turbulent phase. We're losing a lot of our protected constitutional rights and our privacy rights. And most people either, as I said earlier, appear ignorant or comfortably oblivious. And I just feel that I love this country, and I would like to see our full rights restored and an end to this fear-based hysteria that has produced this anything-goes attitude that you described.
Yes, and, you know, my concern also is that this is... all this extensive information on your own citizens is just ripe for abuse. It is going to be abused. It probably already is being abused. And if we want to maintain our democracy, we cannot stand for this. It's, you know, our soldiers are fighting abroad to protect us, to protect our way of life, and here we are at home willfully giving it away.
Diane Rourke, thank you for joining us today.
You're welcome.
Thanks for joining me today. Can I recommend you look up the Fourth Amendment and share it and this podcast far and wide? Thanks.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until